a panda drinking milk.
Of all the animals in the world, there are some that really stand out.
Look at you.
That we think are special.
We find them undeniably, almost unbearably cute.
Millions of us watch these animals online. But behind every feature we love so much, that big round head.
A baby panda, then a tiny frog.
Surprising sounds.
You are super, super cool.
Or those wide eyes is a secret survival strategy.
Sitting with a chimp on his lap.
I'm Gordon Buchanan. I've filmed our favourite animals all over the world. Now, I want to discover the hidden biology of these animal superstars.
A sea lion.
Why this sweet face hides a deadly secret. Why hummingbirds snore. And penguins waddle.
It's making a laughing noise when tickled.
Behind every appealing animal is an incredible story.
And I'm going to reveal their secrets.
Super cute animals. Young elephants with warm brown skin walking in single file.
If you took a poll of the top 20 animals on the planet, I reckon these guys would be right at the top. They are fantastic. Those enormous ears, their trunks, beautiful eyes. I just love them.
But we've all got our own favourites. Animals we find irresistibly appealing.
Hello. How are you doing?
Sometimes we fall for the sounds they make.
Is that an invitation for me to tickle you?
It is. It is.
Others move in ways that delight us. But often, it's simply the way an animal looks that makes it so compelling.
A furry brown sea otter.
And they don't come much better looking than the iconic giant panda.
One eating bamboo.
Famous as a symbol for conservation and for its sneeze.
An infant startles an adult.
Maybe you were one of the 200 million people that watched this online.
An adult eating.
Our monochrome love affair began in the 1970s, when China gave the first pandas to the Smithsonian Zoo. And just last year, their newest baby had over 2 million visitors, all desperate to get a glimpse.
It drops from a tree.
I've come to meet the little crowd pleaser.
Hello, Bao Bao. You really are the most adorable panda in the world.
It climbs.
Pandas really have to be one of the most recognisable animals on the planet, and arguably one of the best loved. They are an extraordinarily good-looking animal.
It grips onto a branch.
Now, pandas aren't the biggest of bears. If you want overall size, you have to look at brown bears or polar bears. But look at the size of that head. It is much bigger, much rounder than that of any other bear. And it's that beautiful big face that really stops them looking like a predator. Makes them look less threatening. And when you look into the face of a panda, you don't feel any threat at all.
With a white head and black eyes and ears, Bao Bao feeds from a bottle.
It's her beautiful face that makes little Bao Bao so appealing. But why is it proportionately so much bigger and rounder than other bear cubs?
A clawed foot.
Pa- Pandas are classed as carnivores. They have the teeth and claws of meat eaters, but they don't act like carnivores. Around 5 million years ago, pandas actually lost the taste for meat. They switched to the food source that was most abundant.
Tall bamboo trunks.
A sensible choice, you'd think, except a stick of bamboo has barely any calories, especially compared with a hunk of red meat.
Gordon crouches behind some bamboo.
So the panda is a carnivore that has gone vegetarian, and it has chosen one of the toughest food sources around, this stuff, bamboo. They don't just eat these nice leaves, which, yeah, to me, pretty unappetizing. They will grind and pulverize even the thickest stems. Oh my goodness. You get into this stuff, look at all those splinters. A bear like the highly carnivorous polar bear can survive for days and days on a single kill, but for a panda to get enough calories to survive just eating this, they have to eat for, wait for this, 16 hours a day. Breakfast, lunch and dinner. It's bamboo. So to cope with the challenges of a bamboo diet, the panda's body has had to change, adapt and evolve to deal with it. Their stomach lining has grown thicker to deal with all those splinters.
A panda eats.
But it's the skull that has changed most dramatically.
Just looking at this skull, you can see that it's unlike the skull of any other bear. The bone itself is much denser, thicker and wider, and that allows these huge jaw muscles to attach.
This gives the panda a stronger bite force than a polar bear.
And it's this bamboo diet that has created this massive head. A massive head that has such an extraordinary appeal for us.
A panda surrounded by bamboo.
The irony is, when covered with fur, this mass of muscle and bone looks like a teddy bear.
She slowly sniffs along the ground.
And Bao Bao's markings only make her more appealing.
A panda emerges from under snow-covered foliage.
In the wild, the eye-catching black and white actually breaks up the panda's silhouette in the snowy forest and makes the eyes look bigger, more threatening to rivals and predators. But the illusion has the complete opposite effect on us.
Walking on all fours.
So why have we fallen for these oversized features?
A panda feeding.
Well, bizarrely, it's all down to our own biology.
Big eyes trigger exactly the same emotional response in us as when we see the panda's oversized head. And that's really because of the way that we respond when we see our own babies. We're all born with these big heads and big eyes. And when we see those features, our nurturing, caring instincts spring into action.
At the sight of Bao Bao's big, baby-like head, blood rushes to our midbrain, part of the brain's pleasure centre. A flood of dopamine is released, one of the hormones produced when we fall in love. This chemical reaction creates emotions. It's what makes us go all gooey.
Psychologists call it the cute response, and the cute response is so powerful, primitive and deep-rooted that it can be triggered when we see those features in other species, in animals.
Our love of the panda is down to our evolutionary hardwiring. We just can't help it.
travelling through the air, high above forested mountainsides. In an orange sky, the sun sinks behind some trees, casting them into silhouette.
The power of the cute response was perfectly demonstrated a few years ago, when a funny little creature grabbed global attention. But I warn you, it's not as sweet a story as it seems.
Its arms are raised.
A video of a ticklish slow loris took the internet by storm. 6 million hits. We couldn't get enough of this wide-eyed little gremlin.
In the wild.
For loris expert Anna Nikaris, the overnight celebrity came as a bit of a shock.
Slow lorises are very rare in the wild, and so until about 10 years ago, hardly anyone had heard of a slow loris, and then they became one of the most popular animals on the internet. For many people, a slow loris is the quintessentially cute animal. Its head is like a little round ball on top of a round body. And it's just got a really sweet, innocent, cute face.
But like the panda, it's the loris's biggest feature that makes it so appealing. Its huge eyes.
Like marbles.
They send our cute response into overdrive.
At night, spots of light are reflected on a slow loris's eyes. A full moon rising over undulating hills.
But it's in the wild that the true purpose of those incredible eyes and the dark side of the sweet little loris is revealed.
Once clinging onto a branch.
Lorises are nocturnal. In the dark, their huge pupils dilate wide. This allows all available light to pass straight into the eye. It gives them excellent vision, even in the faintest of starlight, which they use to stalk and catch prey.
Its hands hover either side of a branch as a large cricket walks along it. Dr. Anna Nikaris.
They may look really cute, but when they grab their prey, they're very vicious, and the first thing they do is shred its head off. And very proudly, they lick it like a little lollipop and eat the entire thing, all the wings, all the bones.
And their appetite isn't limited to insects.
Night vision footage.
This loris has set its sights on a roosting bird.
It flaps as the loris bites it.
If that isn't enough to put you off your dinner, they have an even more unsavory skill.
What strikes one most if you see a slow loris is that they have a long back with a dark stripe. And when they climb, they move like a snake. Their spine moves in an S shape. And if you try to catch one, they hiss at you just like a snake. They raise their arms above their head and they form a hood above their head like a cobra.
Because the internet cutie is the world's only venomous primate.
A loris chews on an insect.
Lorises secrete an oil from their elbow, which, when mixed with their saliva, creates a deadly cocktail.
We know people who've lost half a limb, who've lost fingers, people who've nearly died, and people who have died from their bite. So it's an animal you don't want to mess with, despite the fact it looks so appealing.
So probably best not to tickle one then.
The internet video.
In the case of the slow loris, our instinctive cute response is actually misleading us. We see those big eyes. We imagine the loris is completely harmless. We want to care for it. We even want to own one as a pet.
And clearly, as the world's only venomous primate, it's not the best animal to have around the house. It's illegal to buy lorises, but the demand is so high caused by these videos that lorises have become extinct in many of their jungle habitats. It's a cautionary tale that cute can be a curse.
A loris eating, then Bao Bao drinking milk.
Oversized heads and big round eyes push our biological buttons. But the power of the cute response doesn't stop there.
Gordon's walking along a track in the sunshine.
I'm on my way to meet another animal favourite that proves that almost any feature can be a trigger, as long as it's big enough.
A fox's face with patches of white and red fur, large brown eyes and a small black nose.
This is a fennec, smallest member of the fox family, weighing less than a bag of sugar. But it's not its size that's made the fennec famous. Those are. This little guy has the largest ear-to-body ratio of any carnivore.
They're standing up.
Have a look at those ears. They are phenomenal. Completely oversized. Don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of all foxes, but those ears really are extra special. Hello. How are you doing? You see as he's standing there, the ears are constantly rotating, twitching, just drinking up every single sound. He's showing off his specialist skill. And fennec foxes are incredibly sweet looking, but they're also a very efficient hunter. And those ears are the tools of their trade.
An aerial view of untouched desert dunes under a cloudless blue sky. Two fennecs scamper across the rippled sand, leaving tiny paw prints as they go.
Fennec foxes live out in the shifting sands of the Sahara. In miles of open desert, finding anything to eat can be difficult.
A skink burrows.
A game of hide and seek.
A fennec sniffs the ground.
But fennecs have two unfair advantages.
It digs, then finds a coiled skink, which it tosses, then eats.
Those huge ears act like amplifiers. They gather all the sound and channel it towards the inner ear. Their hearing is so pin sharp, he can hear things I can't hear. And it's said that they can hear a mouse's heartbeat underneath the sand. Quite incredible.
Okay, perhaps you might expect excellent hearing from a set of ears that big. But they have another, even more specialised role.
Wind stirs the sand.
It's not unusual for the temperature to reach 50 degrees in the Sahara. Too hot for most small mammals.
But the fennec fox is different, aren't you? You can actually see when I hold him against the light, you can see the blood vessels through his ear. The skin is so thin that the heat from the blood is lost into the air. And this cooling of the blood, it allows him to keep his core temperature at a safe level. It's what keeps him alive. So in fact, each ear is a radiator, which is a critical survival tool for this fantastic desert-dwelling animal.
The one in Gordon's arms seems perfectly content.
Facial features are clearly a key factor in deciding which animals we find cuter than others. But there's one last physical attribute that tops them all. An animal can have the biggest eyes, roundest face, but if it's not furry, then forget it. The word fluffy gets over 20,000 hits on search engines every week.
A lion cub.
The furrier the animal, the better. Which brings me to America's West Coast.
A harbour.
We associate fur with comfort, softness and warmth, and it's no surprise really that the animals with most fur live in cold places. So why then am I here in California? Well, the answer to that is that the furriest animal on the planet lives just out there.
Gordon thumbs towards the ocean, then walks up a floating gangway. Now sitting in a kayak wearing a dry suit, Gordon's paddling past rows of yachts. There are many birds and sea lions resting on a long stretch of rocks and boulders. A sea lion porpoises by.
Okay, there we go. Just in front of me, I can see the faces of what I'm after. Sea otters. They have to be the most charming animal on the water. I mean, just look at them. That lovely round face, long whiskers. That one's looking a bit slick with all the water. But there's another one that's fluffing itself up a bit. I've got round about 5 million hairs on my body. A sea otter has up to 800 million hairs on its body. That's round about 1 million hairs per every square inch. That is an astonishing amount of hair. And that's what makes sea otters the furriest animal on the planet.
An aerial view of a lake surrounded by dense woodland, then otters in different habitats.
There are 12 other species of otter around the world, all with impressive fur.
Otters chewing on fish.
But it's not nearly as dense as their Californian cousins. So just why is a sea otter so furry?
To relax on the surface.
Sea otters spend 95% of their lives in the water. The ambient temperature is really quite warm, but the water itself is quite chilly, maybe around about 10 degrees. If I fell in there, I probably wouldn't last that long. Other sea creatures like sea lions, walruses, they've got blubber. It's this thermal layer that protects their bodies. Sea otters don't have the luxury of blubber, but what they do have is fur, lots and lots of fur.
What we see are the long, tough guard hairs. They provide a barrier, but aren't completely waterproof. Below is the otter's secret weapon. A dense, soft underfur. By rolling, rubbing and fluffing, they push and trap air in between their fur fibres.
One grooms its face,
which stops cold water ever reaching their skin. But a sea otter's coat is more than just a dry suit. It plays another fundamental role in their survival out at sea.
Sea otters are the most recently evolved marine mammal, and so they're not as fast as seals and sea lions in terms of their ability to catch, you know, swimming fish. Here in California, they eat somewhere between 60 and 65 different species of prey items, typically crab, sea urchin, clam, mussel. One of the adaptations that sea otters have for eating these hard-shelled prey items is that they're tool users. In some cases, it's as simple as picking a rock up off the bottom of the ocean and cracking clams or mussels. But in other situations, it can be much more complex. You know, we've seen otters that use things like bottles as either a hammer or an anvil. They might bang hard-shelled items against docks or boats.
An otter doing just that.
Clever stuff. But what's truly ingenious is how the fur comes into play. Using a tool in the middle of the ocean would be almost impossible. But all that trapped air makes the otter buoyant. And its stomach, a floating work surface.
It rests a shell on its belly,
from which they can consume up to 25% of their body weight in one day. So keeping this fantastically useful fur in tip-top condition is crucial. This pup will rely on mum to keep it warm, dry, and afloat until it learns to groom for itself.
It's lying back on its mum's chest.
But sometimes babies are orphaned or abandoned. And Carl and his team are called in.
Carl puts on a curved plastic-fronted mask.
At the Monterey Aquarium Sea Otter Programme, Carl takes in pups as young as a day old.
One is being bottle-fed.
When we get a stranded pup, all we're trying to do is basically rehydrate the pups, start them on a bottle feeding formula.
It drinks up the mixture.
I should probably explain Carl's get-up. It isn't safety gear. This pup is about as dangerous as he looks. The mask stops the pup thinking Carl is his mother. If he's going to make it in the wild, then it's best he doesn't get too attached.
He rubs the pup with his fingertips.
To mimic the care that a pup would get from mum, Carl and his team run an otter salon.
We start out with big, broad towels to essentially absorb most of the water. And once the fur is sufficiently dry, we'll start incorporating brushes. The brushes then allow us to separate the fur and get the air flow down into the under fur. Might take 10 or 15 minutes at a time. That would be one grooming session, and we're doing this continuously throughout a 24-hour period with the pups.
It's a tough job, Carl, but someone's got to do it.
Their fur is so dense that they essentially float like little corks at the surface of the water, and the water itself is not actually contacting the skin.
He encourages a pup into a water tank. Otters surrounded by kelp.
By the time he's released back into the wild, the pup will have learned all the skills he needs. And his incredible fur will help him survive life as a wild otter out in the bay. For the panda, loris, fennec, and sea otter, supersized features are vital. They will allow them to live in very different and challenging environments, to find food and keep their body temperatures in check. But appeal isn't always just about looks. Sometimes it's the way an animal behaves that makes it a favourite.
Elephants don't have big forward-facing eyes. They're not furry. They're hairy, but not fluffy. And I'd argue with anyone that says, this isn't cute. So something else is going on here. Something else is triggering the cute response. And I think a lot of it is to do with that nose.
A young elephant's been running his trunk over Gordon. An aerial view of a herd.
Like any newborn, the first few months of an elephant's life are a steep learning curve. Walking is tricky enough. But the extra appendage is even harder to get the hang of. Elephants are born with short, stubby trunks. But they elongate rapidly over the first few weeks.
An adult uses it to drink.
Mastering the movement can be a minefield.
A youngster twists his upside down and grabs his tusk.
Baby elephants aren't born trunk trained for the first few months. An elephant's trunk has a mind all of its own. And to watch a baby elephant learn to use its trunk has to be one of the most endearing things in nature.
A young elephant follows the rest of the herd as they move along a grassy plain.
So why is a trunk so hard to get to grips with?
One stands on its own trunk.
Although we find the clumsiness endearing, for the elephant, this period of development is fundamental to their survival. Because the trunk isn't just any old nose. Elephants don't just use it to smell. It's a straw, a hose, a snorkel, and utensil.
An adult turns on a tap. Now, the herd's grazing in the sunshine.
While almost every other limb in the animal kingdom uses muscle and bone together to create fine movement, an elephant's trunk is different. It has no bones. Instead, muscles alone have to stretch, contract, work with and against each other. It's called a muscular hydrostat. Your tongue is another example. Tongues use 8 muscles. But for a trunk to perform all the tasks an elephant needs, well, it takes just a few more.
Elephants tug leaves from a tree.
I've got just short of 650 muscles in my entire body. An elephant, in its trunk alone, has up to 40,000 different muscles. And it has to use each of those muscles in different combinations for different tasks. It makes learning to ride a bike look really rather easy.
Getting the muscle combination right is all about trial and error. It takes practice to master the movement of the most complex and useful nose on the planet.
Youngsters behind Gordon.
By the time an elephant is just 1 year old, it can use that trunk for drinking, lifting, pulling, twisting, even the most precise of movements. So they're really not such slow learners after all.
A stoat leaping.
The way an animal moves can be just as appealing as how it looks. Our emotional response is amplified when it's a young animal learning how to get this movement just right.
In snow, a young fox springs into the air. A small elephant slips in a muddy puddle.
Clumsiness in babies of all species is another major trigger of the cute response.
It tumbles over twice, rising up over a large ice formation, revealing the ocean beyond.
Which probably explains why we love penguins.
6 cross the snowy landscape.
That wonderful waddle from side to side makes a penguin look just like a toddling baby. But unlike our early teetering, a waddle isn't part of a learning process. It isn't refined or finessed.
Leathery orange feet.
A chick remains Chaplin-esque through to adulthood.
2 black fluffy chicks follow an adult closely.
Most animals have evolved to get themselves from A to B efficiently. So why do penguins resort to waddling? Well, although they breed and bring up their chicks on land, most of their lives are spent in the ocean.
Wings outstretched at their sides, penguins waddle into the sea.
Underwater, they are transformed.
They shoot through the depths.
Penguins are highly adapted to live in the water. They have that torpedo-like shape that means they can swim very fast, and they actually really fly underwater. Their chest muscles are very large to drive their wings. Their legs are very short, sort of tucked away at the back. They act as rudders. They can reach bursts of 25 miles an hour, which compared to, say, an Olympic swimmer, is about 6 maximum speed, so they're very agile.
Dr. Ian Staniland.
Emperor penguins, the largest penguins, can hold their breath for over half an hour and can reach depths of half a kilometre. So they're very accomplished divers and very accomplished swimmers.
Underwater, a penguin is a torpedo in a tuxedo. But on land, these fantastic adaptations prove, well, to be a bit of a problem. Short legs and big feet don't help cover distance.
Their chests look pearlescent in the sun.
The waddle was written off as an evolutionary handicap.
Scientists thought that waddling was very inefficient originally, because if you look at the energy consumption of penguins and their walking, it's very high. It was thought that the side-to-side motion was wasted energy.
But then a study of penguin locomotion made a surprising discovery.
Footage of a penguin waddling on a treadmill while covered in sensors.
By swinging their body weight over one foot, then using momentum to pivot onto the next, penguins barely use their leg muscles at all.
So it looks very inefficient, but it can actually recover 80% of the energy it's using for each stride for the next one. So it turns out that it's the best way to get about.
An emperor penguin.
If you aren't built to walk, then waddling isn't a bad solution.
Imagine this is a penguin waddling. Rather than moving forward and using energy to pick up legs and feet, the penguin swings from side to side. Each swing stores up energy for the next swing. That way, penguin can use momentum and gain ground. And waddling might not be the most elegant way of moving around, but a penguin's ability to waddle allows it to survive under the water and on land.
Gordon watches his metronome.
And penguins aren't the only animal whose iconic movement hides a surprising secret.
With thick grey fur, a black broad nose and large fluffy ears, a koala is sitting in a tree. Its ears lift.
Although summer days in the outback can soar past 50 degrees, you'll never see a hot and bothered looking koala.
Too snoozing.
Scientists have recently discovered that koalas' iconic tree cuddling holds a key to survival in the baking heat. While the air temperature sizzles, the bark of a tree can be up to 9 degrees cooler. By pressing the thinner fur of their bellies against the bark, a koala can lose some excess heat and keep its core temperature in check.
A koala rests its head against a tree. Two young elephants bump into each other playfully.
We find weird and wonderful movement incredibly appealing. But for the animals, they're perfect adaptations to get them around a problem.
Turning a tap on.
A dexterous trunk. A comic waddle. Or a cuddle is key to success.
Gordon walks with a chimp.
But it's not just visual clues that trigger our acute response. Sounds can be just as powerful.
On Gordon's lap.
This is Eli. He's a 5-year-old chimpanzee. And it is incredibly easy to see why our species has such a strong affinity for his species. I mean, look, we could be brothers. Well, brothers from another mother.
Chimps hanging from trees, a baby gripping onto branches.
The mannerisms and expressions of apes make them a firm favourite.
A gorilla eating.
We are so alike. And there's one particular behaviour, a sound that we share, that's recently piqued expert interest.
Two youngsters play.
A troop of chimpanzees is just like any human family. They hang out, play, and they laugh.
Gordon looks into the chimp's eyes.
Eli is still a child, and like any child, he shows his enjoyment and his personality through laughter. You tickly. You tickly. You are. You get the right spot. He really, really enjoys it. Look at you. Look at that face. That's good. I've got you.
Eli grins at Gordon.
It's really infectious. You see Eli laughing and it makes you want to laugh.
And recently, scientists started to take laughter seriously.
Baby gorillas playing.
Wondering whether the similarity between the sounds we make might tell us more about our own evolution.
We were interested whether we share emotion behaviors with apes. And there were some very interesting cues that indicated that laughter may have deep biological roots.
In the name of science, Marina started tickling. She collected footage from chimps, orangutans, and gorillas.
They laugh.
We recorded these sounds and used then these sounds in order to conduct a systematic acoustic analysis.
When Marina gathered all the giggles together, a pattern began to emerge. The apes furthest away from us on the evolutionary tree, orangutans and gorillas, made a very simple sound when tickled. But tickling our closer cousins, chimps, produced a more complex laugh sound.
Due to this matching, we could conclude that these vocalizations that we examined were laugh vocalizations, and that apes produce laughter, and that laughter is at least 13 to 16 million years old.
Dr. Marina Davila-Ross.
Bonobos, who are the most similar to us genetically, also had the most human-like laugh. Marina's findings show that laughter has evolved with us.
So you can see when Eli laughs, he laughs like this. So he's using his outward breath and his inward breath.
With his head against Gordon's chest, Eli's lying on his lap.
You see what's happening? When I laugh, it's on the outward breath. And that's something that we do subconsciously, but it's because we can control our breathing, and it's our human ability to control our breathing that has led us to develop speech. So isn't it fantastic to think that we might have laughter to thank for that? You agree? It is fantastic.
We find a chimp's laughter so appealing because we recognise it. It's a sound we associate with pleasure.
Clouds rolling across a sandy landscape.
But sometimes, more unexpected sounds grab our attention. like this desert rain frog. Squeaking viral sensation.
It has a spherical body and thin legs.
11 million hits and counting. It sounds like a dog toy. But actually, this is the sonorous war cry of a very angry frog.
It moves towards the camera.
Ferocious.
A grey bird with a copper-coloured head.
And there's another animal who became an internet celebrity by making an even more surprising sound. A scientist in Peru captured this, escaping from the tiny body of a sleeping hummingbird. A high-pitched but unmistakable snore. Hummingbirds are loved for their beauty and speed, but this one was behaving a little bit like a human. The perfect cute response trigger. But was the online fame deserved? Is this bird really snoring?
Slow motion footage of a hummingbird taking flight. Another lifts off a branch.
Even before the snore, hummingbirds fascinated scientists.
Dr. Don Powers.
From the day I first laid eyes on them, they appeal to me because they are just such unique creatures. They are the only true species of bird that actually can hover for sustained amounts of time. The smallest species will flap their wings about 60 times a second. Try to move your arm that fast. It's pretty difficult. The smallest hummingbirds weigh as little as 2 grams, which is less than a paperclip.
One feeds from yellow flowers.
This rapid movement is a lot to ask for such a tiny body. It uses up so much energy that a hummingbird needs to feed almost constantly.
It dips its long beak into the conical flowers as it hovers.
A sugar-rich hit of nectar every 15 minutes.
Hummingbirds with green plumage fly between plants.
During the day, regularly sipping nectar gives a hummingbird enough energy to survive.
Slow motion footage.
But they can't do this for a full 24 hours. They need rest.
A hummingbird lands on a branch. It has vibrant green and blue plumage. Gordon steps through the forest.
The sun's about to set, and fairly soon I'm going to want to go to sleep. That's not a problem, because through today I've taken on board more than enough calories to see me through the night. But a hummingbird has to feed every 30 minutes or so, even when it's not flying. To sleep through the night without feeding could be incredibly dangerous. So the hummingbird is left with one drastic option, and that is to shut down entirely.
On a bird feeder.
Their heart rate drops from 1,000 beats a minute to just 50. Their breathing becomes almost non-existent. Using just enough energy to stay alive. It's called torpor. And scientists like Dawn are only now beginning to understand it.
Most of what we know about torpor has been learned in the laboratory. We take a hummingbird and we will put it in what we call a metabolism chamber. We measure the oxygen content of the air. If their oxygen consumption gets really, really low so that it's even difficult to measure, then we know that the bird is in torpor.
The snoring hummingbird.
The internet footage is actually from an experiment very similar to Dawn's. The hummingbird has spent the night in torpor to save energy. But that doesn't doesn't explain the snoring.
Sleep and torpor are very different. When we go to sleep, our lungs are still working, our hearts are still beating away, and we can wake up really quite quickly. But for a hummingbird to come round from torpor, it has to kickstart its entire body. It has to get its breathing and its heart rate back up to speed.
Which is exactly what this hummingbird's doing.
The sound is actually a byproduct of them gasping for oxygen. Much like air rushing across, say, vocal cords would.
Coming to with a snore, of sorts. The very sweet side effect of a fascinating survival strategy.
The angry desert rain frog.
We associate high-frequency sounds with surprise, comedy,
a penguin.
And coming from such unexpected animals, they're pretty funny.
The little bird is tickled and stroked. The herd of elephants in the sunshine.
But lower frequencies are proven to be soothing. Calming. Opposite, but equally powerful effects.
A purring kitten.
And it's this soothing quality that has brought us closer to one species than any other.
A domestic cat.
This is an animal that we have an especially close relationship with. Cats have lived side by side with us, sharing our homes for thousands of years. There are an estimated 200 million pet cats worldwide, and over 2 million internet cat videos. I think it's fair to say we're obsessed. They tick all the boxes. Big, forward-facing eyes. Furry. Elegant movement. But the greatest appeal lies in the noise they make.
A cat dozes with its eyes barely open.
I'm not much of a pet cat person. Sahara here is much more my kind of feline. She is an 8-year-old cheetah, and she is absolutely beautiful. But she is also a very powerful predator. So I wouldn't quite want her sitting up on my lap, but just like a domestic cat, she also purrs. Purring is a way of communicating. It's a way of a cheetah saying, I'm okay, I'm relaxed. And they do it when they're grooming, and they do it when they're with their cubs.
The spotty big cat lies on the ground. A mother grooms her cub.
Many cat species purr. Cheetah to Moggy. It's made when the muscles in the throat contract and relax, making air vibrate past the voice box.
Kittens in a basket.
A purring cat is a happy cat. But they'll also purr when injured or unwell. And this is where it gets interesting. Because purring uses energy. And why would a poorly cat waste precious resources?
Her purr really is incredible. You can't just hear it, you can actually feel it thrumming and vibrating through her whole body. And new research has suggested that purring might have some hidden health benefits. The frequency of the purr is very similar to the sound waves that doctors use to help repair muscle and bone. So, while she's resting, she could very well be giving her body a once-over. It's restoration.
A black and white domestic cat crossing a lawn in slow motion.
But unfortunately for us, a purr is not all positive. Cats were first domesticated over 9,000 years ago, which means they've had plenty of time to get to know us. Perhaps too much time. Recent research discovered a second type of purr that cats use. Not to heal, but to get their own way.
Web footage of a cat being stroked.
It's louder and more urgent. And the master stroke is that extra high pitch. A peak of 600 hertz, which mimics the frequency of a human baby's wail.
A cat stretches across a rug.
Cats have perfected a purr that we find impossible to ignore. Using it when they want to be fed or to get a stroke. It's psychological manipulation.
We are powerless to the purr. Cunning and incredibly clever.
The cheetah blinks slowly.
Whether it's a soothing purr, a massive head, or a sweet little snore, the reasons we love certain animals are as diverse and different as the animals themselves. Every comic movement, oversized feature, and wonderful sound tells a story of evolution and survival.
Extraordinary lives need extraordinary features. It's what makes these animals successful. But the way that we are drawn to them, our cute response, really is just a bizarre accident of our biology. The way they look, the way they sound, the way they behave, their biology. That's what's really interesting.